Thank you for that fantastic worship and for your testimony. My goodness. Thank you for sharing that. I'm encouraged, feel like I can say amen and go home after hearing that. What a thrill what God is doing through your life and your ministry. That's encouraging. Now, walking in, some of you were whining this morning about how early it is. I don't want to hear it. I'm on California time. It's still 6:30 and I've been up for 2 hours. Well, not too long ago, a new version of the iPhone came out, and I had to have it. So I got in line at a mall in Southern California near where I live. And I got in line, and I didn't get my phone until about 4 hours later. So I'm standing in line at this mall in Orange County, and the line went down about 4 stores. I'm standing there just waiting, and these 3 high school students come walking up to the guy right next to me. They said, "Hey, we're talking about Jesus. What do you think?" The guy turns around, leans on the railing, and completely ignores these students. A little bit embarrassed, they start to walk away. I said, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" They said, "Well, we're talking about Jesus. What do you think?" I said, "You know, I'm not even sure he existed. Do you really believe that Christian stuff?" The guy looks at me, goes, "Of course we do. Jesus is the Son of God, and he died on the cross for your sins, and if you believe in the resurrection," he's going on and on. He's sharing the gospel with me. And I stopped him. I said, "Now, why should I believe that story? Why should I believe that's actually true?" He holds up his Bible, and he says, "Because it's in the Bible, which is the Word of God, which is completely true." And of course, I said, "Why should I trust that book? Of all books out there, why should I trust that book? And how do I know that book's true?" He said, "Well, if you turn to this passage in 2 Timothy, it tells us that all scripture is inspired." Now, is that a good argument? If you want to know if the Bible's true, can you turn to a passage within the Bible, assuming it's true, to prove itself? I pointed that out to him. I said, "Do you have any evidence outside the Bible that tells us the claims inside of it really happened and that it's true?" He said, "Yes, of course we do. Don't you know there's these tens of thousands of ancient manuscripts that match up and tell us we have the Bible exactly as it was written down?" I said, "Really? Do you know how many words are in the original Greek New Testament?" And at this point, I know exactly what he was thinking. Why did I have to talk to this guy? He goes, "No," I said, "there's about 136,000 words. If you take the manuscripts you're talking about and compare one with the other, do you know there's between 300,000 and 400,000 differences? That means for every word in the Bible, there could be 2 or 3 other words. Can you explain that to me?" He goes, "What do you think about evolution?" I said, "I'm glad you asked. The evidence is overwhelming. Don't you know we have vestigial structures in our back left over from our ancestors with tails? Don't you know humans and chimps share 99.5% DNA? Haven't you seen homologous structures? Haven't you seen embryological development?" I'm going on and on. And the guy's just backing up like this, and his eyes are getting bigger. All of a sudden, I stopped. I said, "You know what? I got a confession to make. I'm a Christian." And I wish you could have seen the guy's face. He goes like this. He goes, "Oh." But then a girl standing next to him looked genuinely bothered by this. She leans in and says, "Was all that true?" I said, "Well, some yes, a lot of it no." Then I said, "Look, like you, I really believe the Bible is true. I said, like you, I believe the world was created. And like you, I believe the gospel. But the difference between me and you is that I know why I believe it's true." I say, "Good for you guys. On a Saturday in summer in Southern California, 10 minutes from the beach, being at the mall sharing their faith. Good for them." But then I said, "Don't you think if you're going to go tell people they should believe in the Bible, you should have some good reasons to back up how you know it's true? Don't you think if you're going to tell people not to believe in this evolutionary story, that you should be able to understand what it is and be able to give some good evidence we're actually designed?" We had a great conversation. They're done. They leave on their way. I'm standing there. I feel a tap on the shoulder. I turn around, and it's 3 new students who say, "We're talking about Jesus. What do you think?" Well, I'm just tired of sitting in line, so I start to launch into my charade again until I stop, and I look over their shoulders, about four or five stores towards the back, I see the original students who set up their friends to convert the atheist. Now, that's exactly what some of you would have done, right? So my question is, did these students love God with their heart? Yeah. Did they love God with their strength? You bet. Did they love God with their minds? Were they prepared with an answer, like Peter said, for those who ask? And my question is, when they get out of their Christian school, when they get out of their church or their Christian family, they go into the university and they hear a professor like I was last night, who doesn't take his glasses off and say, ha ha ha, here's some answers, I don't believe this. And they hear it day after day. If they're not ready, what's gonna happen to these young people? And you know it, don't you? Probably the same thing that happened to one of the most well-known biologists, scientists of our day by the name of E.O. Wilson. You see, E.O. Wilson said, when I was 15, I entered the Southern Baptist Church with great fervor and interest in the fundamentalist religion. I left at 17 when I got to the University of Alabama and heard about evolutionary theory. Now, you might be thinking, gosh, what's the big deal? Why are Christians always bashing evolution? Why don't we just say evolution is true and God used evolution? Why not just accept science and quit fighting it, is what they'll say. Because here's the key. Evolutionary theory has become more than just a scientific idea. Did you hear that? Evolutionary theory has become more than a scientific idea, like plate tectonics or gravity. In fact, it's become the basis of an entire worldview that is in conflict, I would argue, with the Christian faith. In fact, Dinesh D'Souza, who used to work in the Reagan White House, said, "We have Darwinism, but not Keplerism. We encounter Darwinists, but no one describes himself as an Einsteinian. Darwinism has become an ideology." And I think he's right. See, I have a former student, and I tell this to my students. I'm at Biola University now, but I still teach one high school class because I love hanging out with students. And I'll tell them this. I'll tell my students, I'll say, look, when you get to the university, evolution is going to become an ideology, a whole way to look at life. And a girl sent me back an email, and it looked exactly like this. She said, "I've also been inundated with evolutionary theory. Oh my gosh, caps, exclamation point, smiley face." She said, "It's everywhere, my psychology class, my biology class." And then she went on and on about how in her different classes, she was being taught evolutionary theory. Now, does it make sense in biology class to learn about evolution? Yes. Why psychology class? Why sociology? Why does it come up in history? You know why? Because if you take God out of the picture as the basis for an entire worldview, then something has to fill it. And evolution will take that place. It's the creator substitute on our secular campuses and in our culture dominated by naturalism. So there's a well-known atheist by the name of Daniel Dennett, AKA Santa Claus. Mr. Dennett is a professor at Tufts University, very bright, insightful, obviously. He wrote a book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And since he's approaching it as an atheist, I disagreed with most of what he said. But I remember reading a point in there, I stopped and I said, he's exactly right. Listen to what he said. He said, Darwinism is a universal acid. He said, Darwinism is like a universal acid. Now, what does that mean? What does acid do? It dissolves, it corrodes, it eats things away, right? You drop it on this carpet, eats it away. On the stage, eats it away. Metal, wood, it dissolves things and corrodes things in its path. Now, why would Darwinism be like that? You see what his point was? He said, if we have evolved through this blind process, then everything we do and everything we believe ultimately has an evolutionary explanation. Everything does. So there was an article in the New York Times a few years ago. Here's the title, right? You can Google it. It was Why We Like Hot Chilies, an Evolutionary Explanation. So you want to know why we like to burn our tongue sometimes? Evolution must have an explanation. I saw an article not too long ago that said, and I'm not saying this is true or false, this was the name of the article, it said, Why Men Prefer Blondes, an Evolutionary Explanation. And they said, well, on the plains, there were less blondes, and they were competing for that, which was scarce. I'm reading it going, you really think this explains why men are attracted to blondes or brunettes? I mean, do they know anything about men? I don't think that explains it. In fact, this is why we have books like this. Why We Get Sick, The New Science of Darwinian Medicine. Or how about this one? Economics as an Evolutionary Science. You want to understand economics, you got to understand evolution. Or Evolutionary Jurisprudence. You want to understand law, you better look at it through the lens of evolution. Or Religion Explained, The Evolutionary Origins of Religious Thought. Or how about this one? Literary Darwinism. You want to understand literature? You got to understand it through the lens of Darwinism. But this is not just in the world of academia. It actually seeps its way down into popular culture. So you can be honest. How many of you still watch reruns of Friends? Come on, let me see your hand. Okay, I thought so. Well, do you know there was an episode on Friends where one character doubted evolution? By the way, if a character on Friends is going to doubt evolution, who's it going to be? It's going to be Phoebe, right? Why? Because Phoebe is the dumb blonde. I'm not saying blondes are dumb. My 6-year-old daughter is blonde. I speak to her very slowly. There was an episode of Friends, and Ross discovers that Phoebe doubts evolution. Here's exactly how the conversation went. It says, excuse me, evolution is not for you to buy, Phoebe. Evolution is scientific fact. Like the air we breathe, like gravity. See, here's the central question. Are we accidental byproducts of blind forces in nature? Are you the result of this cosmic accident and we're just a big fluke? Or are we the result, the pinnacle of creation intended by a personal and a loving God? Do you see how important this question is? Is this an accidental world where we define truth, we define reality, like Dr. Mueller said last night, existentialism, seize the day before you die, get all you can, live for the moment? Or is this a world in which there's a God who's created us and there's eternity and our decisions about him will affect us forever? That's a huge question. You see, every single worldview has to answer this question. Every worldview answers three questions. If you're taking notes, this would be a good time to write something down. I don't take notes. I don't have to. I have a photographic memory. I just don't have any film. If you don't know what film is, ask somebody over 30. So every worldview answers three critical questions. Number one is it has to have an origin story. How we got here, a creation story. Why are we here? Where did we come from? The second one is what we call the predicament. What went wrong in the world? What's the problem? Why have things gone bad? And then third is the resolution or the solution. How do we fix it? So every single belief system says, here's how we got here, here's why it went bad, and here's how we fix it. So take, for example, the theology taught in the largest church in America. And by the largest church in America, I mean the Church of Oprah. Oprah teaches New Age theology that we are all one with the God consciousness. So we've been here eternally a part of God. The whole problem with the world is we have forgotten that we are God. The problem is you've forgotten the inner divine spark within you. So the solution is you have to be reminded that you are God. Buddhism has a story. We've been here eternally, part of the cycle of samsara. The problem in the world, what went wrong, is we have desires, and our desires bring on suffering. So the solution is to get rid of our desires. That's the Buddhist story. You see, in fact, every single commercial's like this, isn't it? Every commercial starts off and it introduces us to the characters, and then something goes wrong and then they fix it. Right? Think about the commercial. The family's rolling down in their car, singing songs through the mountain. Oh, this is a great American family. A boulder's falling down from the side of the cliff. Problem. Solution. Fortunately, they got the right tires. They're safe. Right? Or the commercial starts off and it's a girl. She looks in the mirror. Oh, American teenage girl. She finds a zit. Problem. Solution, fortunately, she has OxyClear or whatever the heck it is that girls use to cover up zits these days. OxyClear, I just made that up. Couldn't give someone a commercial. Do you see the point? Every belief system, even every movie and commercial, has an introduction. We see this in the Bible. In the beginning, God created, and then there's sin, and then there's a resolution, right? So we know this. What's the Christian story? In the beginning, God created. The Bible starts with a proclamation that we are put here purposefully by God. You're not an accident. You are made in the image of God. We learned that right from the get-go. And the problem is what? Sin. We've rebelled against our Creator. We said, no, actually, I want it my way. Forget you. I can do it better on my own. And what's the resolution? Okay. If you don't know the answer to a question at a church function, just say Jesus. You'll get it right at least half the time. My daughter's in first grade. Last year she was in kindergarten, and they were teaching in kindergarten, they teach students how to not blurt out answers but to raise their hand. So the teacher says, first day of school, she says, class, what's gray, has a big bush of tail, and climbs in trees? And no student raised her hand. She thought, this is weird. Five-year-olds use this. Class, what's gray, has a big bush of tail, and climbs in trees? Nothing. She said, class, raise your hand, I'll call on you, and you give me the answer. What's gray, has a big bush of tail, and climbs in trees? Finally, one of my daughter's classmates raised his hand in the back. She said, yes, Johnny, what is it? He said, I'll say Jesus, but it sure sounds like a squirrel to me. Now, in this case, the resolution is God sends his son, Jesus, to die on the cross for us, and by believing in him, we have eternal life. This is the Christian story, isn't it? The Bible, more than anything else, is a story about reality. Now, in Darwinism, there's a very different story. So Victor Stanger, a well-known new atheist, said, Darwinism implies that humanity developed by accident. You're not made in the image of God. You're not put here purposefully. You're an accident. Now, what's gone wrong in the world on Darwinism? The problem at its core is not moral. The problem is that evolution is kind of a clumsy process. It's not perfect, and things get hurt in the middle of it. And what's the solution? It's not God. It's we must solve our own problems, namely through science. So can you see how different this Darwinian story is about reality than the Christian story about reality? In fact, Darwin himself was aware of where his worldview really led to. This relates to something Dr. Muller said last night. Darwin himself said, the view now held by most physicists is that the sun with all the planets will in time grow too cold for life. Unless indeed some great body dashes into the sun and thus gives it fresh life. Believing as I do that man in the distant future will be a far more perfect creature than he is now. Notice he doesn't say women will become perfect creatures. They're already perfect. Men screwed it up. Just remember that, guys. It is an intolerable thought that he and all other sentient beings are doomed to complete annihilation after such a long, slow, continued progress. What a depressing worldview. This is what Solomon was talking about, wasn't he? Darwin says, what a bummer that we've learned about evolution, how things are improving, because eventually the sun's going to run out of energy and it's all going to be for naught. What a depressing reality if naturalism is really the case. But I don't think it is, and that's what we're going to look at. So I had a chance to write a book on intelligent design with a friend of mine who's a double PhD. It was kind of frustrating. I had to explain so many things to him. And I'll tell you one thing that surprised me. If you didn't notice last night, when I think through an issue, I really try to read both sides. My dad told me, he said, son, there's always two sides to an issue. Read both sides and seek after the truth. So when I was writing this book, I read Darwinists, I read those in favor, those against, and there's something that really surprised me. You know what it was? It was how many evolutionists or Darwinists admit that the world looks as if it were designed. Did you know that? Page after page of these people who don't believe in God, who believe it's all natural, would say, gosh, I don't believe in God, but the world really looks as if it was created. Don't believe me? Richard Dawkins, arguably the most famous atheist in the world, he says, biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, I got a question. If something eats like a duck, smells like a duck, walks like a duck, swims like a duck, and runs like a duck, what do you think maybe it is? Jesus. Oh, God. That is heresy. That is the unforgivable sin. You're done. No, actually, that was funny. I asked for that, didn't I? Maybe it walks, smells, eats, and looks like a duck because it is a duck. Maybe the world looks designed because it's actually designed. Now, to you, you're sitting here saying, that's obvious, but let me tell you something. In our wider culture, especially in the university, to say maybe the world looks designed because it is like this radical statement you can't even make. Isn't that sad how far our culture's come? So what we're going to look at is this. If you remember yesterday, I said the more we learn about science, the smaller the gaps for God become, right? Do you know what the truth is? The more we learn about science and probe the tiniest cell to the origin of the universe, the bigger the gaps become. And the more we see the fingerprint of a designer. So we should not be surprised by Psalms 19, 1 and 2, which says, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hand. Day by day they spew forth knowledge. Night by night they display speech or display knowledge. The natural world reveals truths about God. We're going to look at three quick examples. This is the book I wrote, Understand Intelligent Design. We go into all those different fields. We don't have time to look at all those, but let's begin by looking at physics. How does physics point towards God? Imagine you come and visit me in Southern California, and that's not where I live, just so you know. Behind where I live is all this undeveloped land, and you go walking, and as you're walking up, you see this, what seems to be an abandoned cabin. So you decide you want to go explore. So you go walking into this cabin, but you notice something really strange. You hear the sound of your favorite song, Beat It by Michael Jackson. So you go walking up, you open up the door, you smell the scent of your most beloved meal. You look down, and there's boots and a jacket just your size. You look in the table, it's the books you like to read, magazines. You look over, it's your favorite movies you like to watch and your video game console. You open up the fridge, it's all the snacks you like to munch on. You walk over to the bathroom, you open up, and it's all the toiletries you use. Now, what would you suspect? Besides thinking that somebody is stalking you, what you would know for sure that this wasn't chance, that somebody arranged this cabin with you in mind, right? There's too many things set precisely for you to be ascribed to chance. Someone was expecting you to come. Do you know what Freeman Dyson, a well-known scientist, not a Christian, says? He says, as we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked to our benefit, it almost seems as if the universe must in some sense have known that we were coming. You know what this means? That the universe as a whole is just like this cabin. There's certain laws of physics that govern the whole universe that all have one strange thing in common. They're precisely where they need to be to have a universe even capable of supporting life. So philosophers call this the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God. You get in the shower in the morning, you take the hot and the cold, what do? You fine-tune it so it's just right. The laws that govern our universe are fine-tuned and are just right. So it's like Goldilocks. Goldilocks goes and the porridge is too hot, it's too cold, and it's just right. We live in a universe where the laws that govern it are just right. So one philosopher said, it's like the laws of physics exist on a razor's edge, and the slightest change to the left or the right, and the entire universe would be inhospitable to life. Frederick Hoyle, who coined the term Big Bang, he said, as we look at the universe, it almost seems as if someone has been monkeying with physics. That's why Paul Davies from Arizona State University, not a Christian, but a brilliant scientist, he said, the cliche that life is balanced on a knife edge is a staggering understatement in this case. No knife in the universe could have an edge that fine. Now, here's what he means. So I had mentioned that I went to Biola University. In my senior year, some of my friends lived in this dorms called Thompson. It was on the back part of campus, and they were on the second or the third story. And the reason this is so great is they had a window, and out of the window was a huge parking lot, a tall row of trees, a big gutter for water, and then a stop sign. So we got the brilliant idea that at night we would use one of those huge, like, massive water balloon launchers. You know these things that take like three people? They look like a huge rubber band, right? They actually three people, like one person holds it on this side, one person holds it on this side, and then you pull back the middle, you put a water balloon, an egg, a cat or something in it, and you let it go. And it goes flying. Well, we thought we could go to the window and we could launch water balloons all the way over, and when cars come home at night, welcome them home with a water balloon on the windshield. I mean, senior year in college, this is what 4 years in the university will convince you is a great idea. So we tried and tried and tried, and we always missed. And one time we saw this small red car coming back. And it was like slow motion. We're like, open the window, get the launcher. So we're running, we're intense, the lights are off so no one can see us. I hold it on this side, my buddy holds it this side in the window, my friend pulls it back, puts a water balloon in, lets it go, and it flies. It goes across the parking lot, clears the row of trees, goes over the water gutter, the car stops at the stop sign, bam, smacks it right on the windshield and shatters it. She has a heart attack. No, I'm just kidding. It's not that bad. That's actually morbid. You guys laughed at that. That is very morbid. When a windshield cracks, it does like the spider crack all over it? It was one of those. Needless to say, our water balloon launching days came to an immediate end because we had to pay for it, right? And that costs a lot of money. I live in California. I didn't have the money, especially when I was a student. Well, I want you to think about how many things we had to get right to hit our target. What would have happened if we had more water in the balloon? Even a slight bit more. It wouldn't have gone as far, would it? It would have gone further if we had less water, not as far if we had more water. What happened if we had pulled the trajectory back a little bit? It would have gone further. What happened if we went to this side, or the angle was down, or there was wind? Can you think of all the things that had to be just right to hit our target? You know what scientists have learned about the universe? That since its beginning, the universe is expanding in every direction. But the mass of the universe must be just perfectly fine-tuned. If it was less, the universe would expand too quickly. If it was more, the universe would crunch back in on itself. So Mark Horton, a NASA scientist, said, if the balance between gravity and the expansion rate were altered by one part in 1 million, billion, 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 there'd be no galaxies, stars, planets, or life. You know what that's equivalent to if you put that mathematically? The amount of fine-tuning the universe is equivalent to one grain of sand compared to the mass in the entire universe. If it varied that much more or less, our universe could not support life. That's just crazy to think about, isn't it? Well, this is only one example. Scientists have found at least 30 parameters that must each be set for there to be life. So what happens if we take, say, two of these, what's called the force of gravity and the cosmological constant? What are the chances that they would all be fine-tuned just right for life? The equivalent is 2 of the 30 would be the equivalent of 1 in 100 million, trillion, 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 trillion. That's a big number. If you can't grasp that number, just think of our new national debt. Some of you are like, oh, that's bad. I got it. You know what this is actually equivalent to roughly? One atom compared to all the mass of the entire universe. So what happens if we take all of the parameters that must be fine-tuned for life? Roger Penrose said, if we combine all the laws that must be fine-tuned, he's from Oxford, we couldn't even write down that number in full, since it would require more zeros than the number of elementary particles in the universe. That's incredible. So to me, when we see the laws of physics are fine-tuned, the best explanation is a cosmic fine tuner and intelligence that has arranged it that way. Well, let's look at a second example. We're going to look at a couple ones, and we'll have time for just a few questions. How about the world of biochemistry? So let's go from the massive down to the small. All right, so Darwin himself once said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. You realize what Darwin's doing? He's given what's called a criterion of falsification. It's a way to prove his theory wrong. So who can tell me if we found this, it would prove Christianity false? What is it? The body of Jesus. If I had the femur of Jesus in my bag, number one, I'd be rich. Number two, Christianity would be false. He's not risen. We're still in our sins. And we are to be pitied, says Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. So if you want to disprove Christianity, find the body of Jesus and it's done. Darwin did the same thing. He said, if you could find a complex system which could not have developed in a step-by-step manner, he said this would disprove his theory. Now, interestingly enough, in 1996, and this came up yesterday, somebody asked me about this. Michael Behe, a biochemist from Lehigh University, wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. Now, why did he call his book Darwin's Black Box? A black box is something that's very interesting, but we don't know how it works. Okay, so this clicker that I'm using is a black box to me. I know how to push the slides forward, but I don't have a clue how it actually functions. I have no idea how they make this thing work. It's a black box. In fact, the ultimate black box to me is women. My wife and my daughter are fascinating to me, but I don't have a clue what makes them tick. So he called his book Darwin's Black Box because during the day of Darwin, they didn't have a clue how the cell worked. They thought it was very simple and there would be an easy explanation. But as technology progressed and time moved forward, we now find in the cell more complexity and sophistication than anything humans can come close to creating today. So he gave a concept very important. He said, an irreducibly complex system is one that requires several closely matched parts in order to function, where removal of one of the components effectively causes the system to cease functioning. Now, what does this mean? Okay, look. If a system's irreducibly complex, you can't reduce it without it losing its function. There's certain core parts that must be present. Okay, so take, for example, that Michael Behe gives is a mousetrap. Why do we need mousetraps? Because we launched all the cats. Just bringing it full circle. Now, if you take a mousetrap, there's at least 5 different parts that are necessary for the mousetrap to function. So you have the wooden platform, you have the spring, you have the catch, you have the hold, and you have the hammer that they call it. You can guess what that's for. Well, for this to function, all the parts must be in the right place at the right time, in the right configuration for it to work. What happens if one of those parts is gone? How well does it work? Does it work 80% if one part is gone? Does it work 50% if two parts are gone? No, it's either all or what? Or none. So here's the interesting thing. Darwinian evolution could not explain building of a mousetrap. Why? Because any simpler system lacking a part would have no function, so evolution would weed it out. Natural selection would get rid of it. But it also can't show up at once, just bam, in place, because it's too complex and mathematically improbable. Now, of course, you're looking at mousetraps saying, well, mousetraps are man-made, and you're right. The question is, that Behe posed, is there anything like a mousetrap in nature? An example he gave that someone asked me about last night is called the flagellum. The flagellum, in case you haven't seen this, is a bidirectional motor on the back of certain bacteria that propels it through water. Now get this, it spins up to 100,000 RPMs. That's crazy. The Honda S2000, their sports car, has 9,000 RPMs. It can go 100,000 RPMs, stop within a quarter turn, and go full speed the other direction. This is crazy. That's why Howard Berg from Harvard University said it's the most efficient motor in the universe. Far more efficient than anything we can engineer. But here's the issue with the flagellum. Like a mousetrap, there's at least, though in this case there's more, there's at least 40 proteins that must be present for the mouse, for the flagellum to function. And if one of those proteins is gone or some equivalent is not there, how well does it function? It doesn't function at all. So do you see the problem that he posed to Darwinian evolution? He said you can't get a flagellum in a step-by-step manner because any simpler system would be lacking a part and it would have no function. But it also couldn't just show up in the right place at the right time because that's mathematically impossible. And Darwin specifically said his theory is a step-by-step process. Now, if you get on Wikipedia or online, most critics will say, Michael Behe is an idiot. They've disproved it a long time ago. This argument doesn't work. But what they never produce is a step-by-step Darwinian explanation for how something like a flagellum could be built without intelligence. They don't. Rather, they have just so stories. Oh, this could have happened, and since this is possible, we win. Well, that's not how it works. Evolution is a process. And if I'm to believe that this happened through a blind process, and that's the most reasonable, I want to see a step-by-step explanation of how it actually happens. And I can tell you, because I've looked into it, that none have actually produced this. Most critics will say they have, but occasionally some honest ones will come forward and admit that they have not. And David DePue from a university in Iowa said, I could not agree more with the claim that contemporary Darwinism lacks the models that can explain the evolution of cellular pathways and the problem of the origin of life. And he's absolutely right. So take a step back for a second. When we look in the world of physics, we see fine-tuning that points towards a cosmic fine-tuner. We go down small and we see engineering that points towards an engineer. Let's look at one last example in the world of biology. And this has to do with DNA. Do you know, most people think biology is a study of living systems. It's actually not. David Baltimore, Nobel laureate, said, modern biology is a science of information. You know what that means? Is if you study biology, you are studying information systems. The creation, the process, the delivery of information. So for example, the human body, your body is like a memory stick. Every cell in your body stores massive amounts of information. Do you know how much information is in your body? This was harder for me to believe when I first learned it, but check this out. On average, the average human body has 100 trillion cells. 100 trillion cells. If you took the DNA out from one cell in your body and you uncoiled it, it would be 9 feet in length. That means all the DNA in your body strung together would go from here to the sun and back about 70 times. This is where you say, wow. I mean, just think about that for a second. The DNA in your body from here to the sun and back 70 times? That's crazy. Well, you know what DNA does is it stores information. How much information? So one cell in your body has the equivalent of 8 billion letters, 500 million words, or 8,000 books of information. In fact, one study I saw this past summer estimated that the average cell in a human body can store the equivalent, get this, 500,000 DVDs of information. Wouldn't you like to have a memory stick with 500,000 movies on it? Some of you would still get bored. Well, this has raised an interesting question. Where does this come from? Because the cell is so complex, even Bill Gates of Microsoft said, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. And yes, that's also true for Apple. So here's the question. I hope you've thought about it. There's so much information and complexity, even in the tiniest cell. What best explains where this information comes from? Well, those who do not believe in intelligent design have a common explanation, and it reminds me of a popular comedy from a generation ago. Let's take a look at this clip.
I'm going to ask you a question. Straight out, flat out, I want you to give me the honest answer. What do you think the chances are of
I love that clip every single time. Right, obviously when she says 1 out of 1,000,000, what does she really mean? She means no, he doesn't have a chance. Right, do you know one of the most common explanations for the origin of life without God is chance? I just took 12 high school students through a book called The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. My atheist friends told me this is the top atheist book you've got to read. We came to the question of the origin of life. You know what his explanation was? Four letters. Luck. We got lucky, and then evolution took over. That sounds like it takes a lot more faith to me to believe in that than there's an intelligent mind. So Richard Dawkins came up with an explanation called the Monkeys Typing Shakespeare Theorem. He said, if we have enough monkeys and enough typewriters or computers, and they sit down and start typing at random, eventually one of these monkeys will type out all the works of Shakespeare. Do you know what his thinking is? Notice this. He's trying to explain how you get information through a blind, purposeless process. Because if there is no God, you have to come up with some natural explanation. So the question is, could monkeys typing at a computer in our universe eventually produce all the works of Shakespeare? Well, interestingly enough, there was actually an MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a scientist and mathematician by the name of Seth Lloyd. He mathematically quantified, given the size and age of our universe, how much information could arise by chance. So that's a good question. How much information could arise by chance? Could the cell arise by chance? You know what he concluded? Not all the works of Shakespeare, not one work of Shakespeare, not a chapter of Shakespeare, not a page of Shakespeare, not a paragraph of Shakespeare. All the resources of our entire universe by chance at best could produce four lines from one work of Shakespeare. To be or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer. Well, about 10 years ago, some scientists and professors and students got together and decided to test the monkeys typing Shakespeare theorem. So they actually put some monkeys in a zoo, the Paignton Zoo, with some computers to see if one of them would sit down and start typing out Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet. Well, one of the first monkeys comes up and starts bashing the computer. Another monkey climbed up on top and went to the bathroom on the computer. But before you laugh, believe it or not, in the weeks they were in there, these monkeys produced over 6 pages of written text. I know, it's incredible. These monkeys produced over 6 pages of written text. A string of A's, L's, M's, occasional J, and a few S's. Not a single word. Now, in case you haven't taken advantage of the resources in the back and you'd still like to buy something to read, you can purchase the literary works of these monkeys because they've been put into a volume called Notes Towards the Complete Works of Shakespeare. You can actually purchase that online. Now, here's the deal. If you come and visit me in Southern California, all right? And we go walking on the beach. And by the way, now that we've been hanging out for these couple days, if you do ever come visit me in Southern California, especially when you're college, you need a warm cooked meal, you need a place to stay, you need somewhere to do laundry, you let me know. And I'll pray for you. So we go walking on the beach and you come across markings in the sand that says, John loves Mary. Now I doubt any of you would stop and go, whoa, that's crazy. I've heard about earthquakes on the West Coast, but I had no idea when the ground shook, messages arose from the deep. None of you would say, whoa, crazy, crazy tides here, or look at how gravity works on the West Coast. Look at what wind and erosion produces, messages. None of you would think that for half a second. You would be walking on the beach, and if you saw a physical marking like this, you would know that either John does love Mary, or maybe Mary wrote it because she wants to be loved by John. Or maybe someone's playing a trick on both of them. But you would know for sure that this didn't happen by some chance or physical necessity or laws of nature. The only explanation for this that you would buy is that an intelligent mind wrote it. You see, Stephen Meyer, who's trained at Cambridge University, he said, whenever we find information and we know the causal story of how that information arose, we find that it always find that it arose from an intelligent source. So I noticed someone's shirt in the back says Gap. If you trace that back, there's a designer. Who wrote that? You pick up a book, you trace it back to an author. You pick up a newspaper, trace it back to a journalist. You get a text and it's legible, trace it back to a texter. If we walk outside and we look up in the clouds and it says drink Coke, and I said, whoa, what caused that? None of you would turn to me and say, oh yeah, that happens here in Kentucky when a storm is coming from the east. You would know a pilot or a mind went through and wrote that. Well, when we look in DNA, we don't see the equivalent of John loves Mary or drink Coke. We see more information that's more complex and more vast than anything humans can come close to creating today. I don't have enough faith to believe that happened by chance. I think the information in the DNA points towards an author of life. And it's not just me who argues this. Interestingly enough, a few years ago, I don't know if you remember this story or not, but keep this in mind, for 5 decades, the most widely read atheist in the world, philosophical atheist, was a guy by the name of Antony Flew. He first wrote a paper before C.S. Lewis at the Socratic Club at Oxford in the 1950s, arguing that belief in God was meaningless. He died, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago or so. But before he died, he released a book. You know what it was called? Get this. There Is a God. Why the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. What changed his mind? He said when he started back in the 50s, there was no scientific evidence pointing towards God. But through the decades, more and more evidence came out, and it points towards an intelligent mind. So he wrote specifically, he said, what I think the DNA material has done is to show that intelligence must have been involved in getting these extraordinarily diverse elements together. What I think DNA material has done is show that intelligence must have been, oh, I read that once. Just kidding. The enormous complexity by which the results were achieved looks to me like the work of intelligence. And I think he's right. I presented this at a conference not too long ago, and a girl came up to me. She goes, man, that scientific evidence is compelling. It points towards God. She said, do you think the other side will ever concede and say there must be a God? I said, absolutely not. See, I'm convinced that many objections, if not most, to God really don't boil down to a lack of evidence. People can reject God for a lot of different reasons. It can be an emotional reason, you've been hurt. It can be a volitional reason, I don't want to believe in God. It can be a moral reason by counting the costs. I had a friend call me out of the blue a while ago, and I answered the phone. He said, hey, he called me up and he said, hey, you teach your students how to defend Christianity, right? I said, yeah. He said, where do you start? I about fell out of my chair. I said, why are you calling me? Because I talked to him about God for a decade and no interest. I said, why are you calling me? He had a friend who was only 15 at the time who had a brain tumor. He said, it's shaken me up to my own mortality. I said, all right, let's go to coffee and let's talk about it. We sat down. He looks me in the eyes. By the way, this guy got perfect scores on his SATs in math. Looks at me in the eyes, he says, I'm scientific-minded. Can you give me any proof that God exists? Pulled out a napkin, I wrote down some of the stuff we talked about. He goes, okay, that makes sense. I think there probably is a God. How do you know the Bible's true? I walked him through manuscripts, archaeology, confirmed prophecy. He goes, how do you know Jesus is God? I walked him through the miracles, prophecy. And at the end, he goes, you know, I think I believe Jesus is God. But I'm not ready to commit. Fast forward a few years, I talked to him again. I said, hey, I'm just curious. Where are you at with this? He said, well, I've got two things holding me back. He said, number one, I don't like Fox News. He was under the impression that if you become a Christian, you have to hold certain political views and you have to hold them with a certain attitude. I said, don't worry about politics. There's room to differ within the faith. The question is, who's Jesus? Then he said, second, I don't know what my friends would think. Right then and there, I knew the issue had nothing to do with truth. But he wanted to live his life a certain way. Friends, for those with eyes to see and with ears to hear, God has made himself known. He's made himself known in the tiniest cell, as if he's autographed in DNA every cell. In the depths of the universe, Romans 1 tells us that God's power and his creativity can be known by looking at the world God has made. God has revealed himself through the church. He's made himself known through the scriptures. He's made himself known through the Holy Spirit. Those with eyes to see and ears to hear, God is real. But the heart of the problem is the problem of the heart. Will we stand before our Creator and say, may your will be done. I submit before you and realize you created everything and spoke it into existence. I think you know what you're doing. I'm going to follow your plan. That's the question that all of us have to honestly answer. Now, I've got 5 minutes, and I'm going to take some questions. We're going to have to be fast because you have some breakouts that are coming up. If you have a question and want to raise your hand quickly, I'm not going to role play the atheist. That is done. Any questions from something last night that kept you up or from this session that I can help you with? Yes, in the back. Yep. Yeah, as far as prophecy, I would probably take people. I think Isaiah 53 is powerful. I mean, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the book of Isaiah was written long before the time of Christ, at least a century before. And in Isaiah 53, it talks about this suffering servant, that he would die for the people, that he would be buried, etc. And that was fulfilled specifically in the person of Jesus. And you see in Acts chapter 8, Philip, the evangelist, talking about Isaiah 53 in his conversation with the Ethiopian eunuch. So if I was just going to go to one prophecy, I'd probably take him to Isaiah 53. But you can also take him to Zechariah chapter 9. You can take him to Micah when it talks about where the prophet would be born from, Bethlehem. And you look at how small Bethlehem was at that time. But if I just had one, I'd probably take somebody to Isaiah 53. So good question. Yes. Yeah, where should they start? So here's the thing to keep in mind. To share your faith with somebody, you don't have to read 50 books and have an answer for everything I said yesterday. I do this for a living, okay? Most atheists don't know as much as I do about atheism. That's not to knock atheists any more than I would knock Christians don't know our stuff as well as we should. But I've studied. I did this presentation one time, and this guy comes down the middle at the end. He goes, "Man, that was good. You defended atheism better than I could." And I'm an atheist, not an atheism. You meant what I knew. So I don't want you to get the impression that you're thinking, "Oh, I can't share my faith with anybody until I read 50 books." But I would say one critical part of being a Christian is loving God with our minds. Knowing why we believe what we would believe. So it's not enough to know that your youth pastor or your parents or a speaker this weekend or some Christians have answers. You don't have to become a professional apologist, but you do have to start to learn why you believe what you believe. So there's some series that youth pastors can get. For example, I did a series called God Quest. It's just a 6-part series where we work through different apologetic issues. It's kind of a simple introductory level to apologetics you might like called God Quest, youth leaders and parents, and I would take your students after that through Focus on the Family series called True You. Fantastic. Every single young person here, you should have a leader take you through True You. There's one on Does God Exist, one on Is the Bible Reliable, and one on Who is Jesus. Work through those together and take notes and talk about it, and your faith will build up and your confidence will grow. And also get a book or two, not just one here. Go to the library on campus and just get one or two books, a simple one. Read a little bit, and over time, your confidence and your faith will grow. Okay? Excellent question. We'll do one more and we'll wrap up. Yeah. Can I talk on how the fragile balance of how Earth holds life? Sure. Let me make a comment about this. When I was talking about the universe being fine-tuned, I was talking about certain laws of gravity, physical laws and constants that are universal. There's another level of fine-tuning I didn't even mention. And that's actually, so for example, for there to be life on our planet, we have to have the right size of sun, of the right distance, of the right age. We have to have a planet of a certain size. We have to have certain core. We have to have an iron core. If we didn't have an iron core, we wouldn't have a magnetic field, and we would be killed by rays from the sun. We have to have a certain tilt for there to be life. We have to have a certain speed of rotation. We have to have a certain kind of orbit around the sun. See, if this was a sun and our orbit went like this, it'd be freezing, super hot, freezing. It has to be circular. We also have to have a moon. Look at the moon and how all the things that have hit the moon, it's like a little shield that protects us. We also have to have outer planets for there to be life on our planet. So in 1994, there was a huge comet called Shoemaker-Levy, multiple nuclear bombs heading towards Earth. Jupiter sucked it in and it hit Jupiter and it protected us. So there's all these things that are just right about our size and our location. And then on top of that, here's something I learned was really cool. I will leave you with this. Think about it. If you went into downtown LA and you saw a telescope, would any of you wonder why they put a telescope to look at the stars in downtown LA? Not a very good spot, is it? Because there's light pollution. If you're hiking on remote mountains in, say, Nevada, and you come across a telescope, would you think that's a pretty good place to put it? You put discoverers in the best place to make discoveries. Do you know what we've learned about Earth? Not only is Earth the best place for there to be life, it's the best place in our solar system to make discoveries. So our atmosphere is just right to see through and make discoveries. Our place in the galaxy is just right so there's not light pollution and we can make discoveries. It's incredible. So take a solar eclipse. Do you know with a solar eclipse, there's only one place in our entire solar system where you can see a solar eclipse, only one surface. And it happens to be the only surface in which there are people to observe a solar eclipse. That's because you put observers in the best place to make observations. I think God put us here to understand and learn about the universe, and we can see that purpose by studying our location. Unbelievable stuff. I love it. But you have some breaks coming up, some breakout sessions, so I've got to let you go. But I'll tell you this, the book Understand Intelligent Design is back there. Everything I talked about, you can take advantage of that. And there's only 2 study Bibles left. That's it. Grab them before they're gone. I'm going to turn it over to Dan and then sneak back there. I'd love to say hi to you and answer more questions if I can. You guys have been awesome. Thank you. Thanks, Dan.